Hello, my name is Rod Barnett, and I am your genial host for The Bloody Pit. This is the first episode of what I hope will be many. This is going to be what I will refer to as an occasional podcast, one without any regular schedule or any real idea, at least on my part, of when a new episode will appear. When you see one, you see one. The beauty of this podcast is going to be that it can be just about any subject. Well, as long as it's fairly movie-related. But then again, we may end up talking about TV shows, comic books, heck, whatever comes to mind. As long as it seems to fit within the purview of The Bloody Pit and my blog, The Bloody Pit of Rod, that's what we're going to talk about. I'll be doing the occasional episode, like this one, on my own, and then quite a number of episodes with special guests. Those episodes will revolve around whatever subject that particular guest wants to talk about, and I got the feeling there's going to be some really interesting ones coming down the pike. I have a number of very interesting and quite eclectic friends with very strange tastes and interesting insights into film, music, and comic books, not to mention novels. And so I think this is going to be something fun. At least, I intend to have fun. I certainly hope you do too. So, settle back. No schedule. No way of knowing when these are going to come out and how. But, if you tune in, I promise you that it will at least be fairly entertaining and something at least worth listening to. I'm going to start this first episode off with a kind of introduction. Not an introduction really for the podcast, although it serves as that as well, but an introduction for you to me. And I think that one way to do that, especially in something that's going to revolve around opinions about film, is for me to lay out what I consider to be my 10 favorite movies of all time. This is a list I put together some time ago, and even though I've been tempted to change things here and there, it still has remained my favorite 10 movies for a very long time. And as I go along, I'll explain why. So, sit back. This is a short way to get a look inside my head, to get a feel for what kind of movies I really like and the ones that I come back to over and over and over again. And we'll go from there. These are 10 films that I will always be able to watch. If you put them on tomorrow, I could watch them. If you put them on next week, I could watch them. I've watched them for years and years, and I still think they're fantastic. I still enjoy them, and I'll always be able to enjoy them, at least as far as I can tell. I'll go in reverse order. Number 10, Planet of the Apes, 1968. Seriously, folks, I could watch this movie every 6 months and still enjoy every single minute. I've seen it labeled as a quote-unquote near classic by the old classic Leonard Maltin film guide, the movie guide. What the hell does that even mean? Planet of the Apes is one of the great science fiction films ever. Calling it anything less than a classic is quite simply an insult, and hell, I even like the sequels. Planet of the Apes is the kind of film that they only wish they could make these days. It's so good, it stands up. 44 years later, and 44 years from now, it'll still be looked upon as the brilliant piece of filmmaking that it is. Planet of the Apes is a movie for the ages. No sequels, no remakes, no anything will ever dim the brilliance of that movie. Number 9, Dawn of the Dead, 1977. Horror films don't come any gorier, tenser, creepier, or better written than George Romero's zombie masterpiece. The fact that most of the scary stuff happens in broad daylight only adds to the feeling of a world gone completely mad. I personally prefer the 140-minute cut, but the shorter cut will do in a pinch. I know that the 140-minute cut was made by Romero just to get it out the door so that the film could be shown at the Cannes Film Festival, but man, the things he eliminates in that 126-minute cut, I don't necessarily feel they're vital, but God, they add so much wonder and joy and character to the story. There's a part of me that wonders if there's a 160-minute cut that should exist somewhere in an alternate universe. Dawn of the Dead is a great movie. It has everything you need and more. Romero has done other films since then, and some of them brilliant movies. But Dawn of the Dead showed him simply at the height of his powers, showed him at the peak of creativity. It's something others should aspire to. Number 8. Vertigo, 1958. Alfred Hitchcock at his most effective. Beautiful and melancholy, Vertigo speaks to that part of us that wants to know the truth, but also knows that the truth can be an awful thing. Vertigo is Hitchcock's greatest film. North by Northwest is more exciting. Psycho is slightly more disturbing on a surface level. But Vertigo digs into your soul, holds that mirror up, and forces you to realize that you are a dark, nasty person who needs to think seriously about what it is you love and what it is you covet. Vertigo is as near to perfect as Hitchcock ever got. With number 7, I'm going to have to admit that I'm cheating. Well, kind of cheating. I'm not cheating in a way because it's really one big movie. It just has two separate names. I'm talking about The Three Musketeers and The Four Musketeers, released in 1973 and 1974. Oh my lord, it is just one big movie telling one big story. And if you don't think it's one big movie, just ask the actors. They only got paid for one, and they had to sue the producers, the Salkinds, to get paid. This is, in my opinion, the best version of the Alexandre Dumas novel, and one of the best swashbuckling films ever freaking made. With a great cast, and many career-best performances from that cast. Also, the best swordplay humor of all time. If the movie doesn't have you laughing at not just the slapstick, but the character interplay during a lot of the slapstick, then I don't know what kind of person you possibly can be. The Three and the Four Musketeers is absolutely one of the best movies of all time. Stunning, stunning stuff. I wish there was a fifth Musketeer film. Or would that be just like, they did a sequel kind of later on, years later, and Roy Kinnear died when they made it from some kind of horse accident. Anyway, it doesn't matter. The Three and the Four Musketeers, 1973 and 1974. An amazing cast. You've got Oliver Reed, Richard Chamberlain, Michael York, Frank Finlay, Raquel Welch, Charlton Heston, Christopher Lee. The list goes on and on. If you've never seen those movies, just check it out. I guarantee you, you've watched the first 30 minutes, you'll want to watch the whole thing. Great stuff. Number 6, Danger Diabolic from 1968. What is it with all the amazing horror films that Mario Bava made? Somehow I end up choosing his pop art comic book thriller to go on my list of 10 favorite movies. Am I some kind of lunatic? Yeah, well, that may be. Still, this is one great movie. It moves like a shot. Watching a master criminal outsmart the cops has never been this much fun before or since. And Ennio Morricone's score is unforgettable. This is the way comic book films were made for decades if they knew what they were doing. Next to this, even a lot of comic book films that come out today look dull and lifeless. Danger Diabolic is exactly the kind of film that I can cherish and watch over and over and over again because it's funny, it's witty, it is intensely intelligently done, and while it winks at the audience, it has absolutely zero contempt for that audience. This movie was made for movie fans, and it's a blast. Number 5, The Thing, 1982. One of the most influential horror movies of the last 30 or 35 years, second only to Alien, and it's also one of the best. Paranoia elevated to high cinematic art and backed up with some of the goriest special effects they could think of. I love the 1951 original version done by Howard Hawks, but Carpenter's remake aka going back to the source material and making a new film from it, is stunning. In actuality, I like both versions of the thing pretty heavily, and would rate them about the same on a 1 to 10 scale. But Carpenter's film is one that I've returned to again and again and again and again because it has so much tension, it is so clever, it has so many surprises that even after you've seen the shock effects repeatedly, the movie still works. Kurt Russell is fantastic in it too. If you've never read the source story called Who Goes There, seek it out and you'll see that Carpenter and his scriptwriter Bill Lancaster went back to the source and crafted a fantastic film. Number 4. King Kong 1933, the original and the best. Beauty and the Beast writ large, with a monkey. A stop-motion monkey. It's a beautiful fantasy that still makes me cry every time I see it. King Kong is a wonderful creature, a wonderful story, and a great film. Plus, hey, I just like watching apes kick dinosaur ass. Of course, that doesn't mean I really enjoyed the Peter Jackson version of this story, because, let's be honest, that thing's about 2 hours too long. But the 1933 original, that's a film that everyone should see, and even if you don't enjoy it, which I could never understand if you didn't enjoy it, it must be seen. It is a work of art and one of the greatest films from the decade of the 1930s. And there were a lot of great films made in the 1930s, people. King Kong, seek it out. If you've never seen it, you owe it to yourself. Number 3. Fight Club, 1999. This is maybe the best film David Fincher will ever direct, and the fact that something this good can be made these days is a testament to the survival of the creative spirit in Hollywood. Fight Club has a perfect cast, razor-sharp direction, an incredible script, and one of the best whipsaw endings ever put on celluloid. It only gets better with subsequent viewings. It's funny, it's sad, it's hopeful, and it is nihilistic at times. It's all this and more. Fight Club is a stunning cinematic adventure, something so bold and shocking that I can understand why some people will not like it. But Fight Club is fantastic. David Fincher has gone on to make a lot of great movies. A lot of great movies. But Fight Club will probably be on his tombstone. An amazing achievement. Number 2. Citizen Kane, 1941. Touch of Evil is a fantastic film, but for me, as much as I love Touch of Evil, and I love Touch of Evil, Citizen Kane is just slightly better. What can I say about a Citizen Kane that hasn't already been said? It's brilliant from start to finish. It's as close to perfect as I think a movie will ever get. It is sheer genius. I can start that movie at any point in its running time and just keep watching. There was a period of time where I watched that movie 3 times in 1 day, and then about a week later watched it twice more, just going back through it. Of course, this was because I just bought it on videotape and was just kind of obsessing over it. My taped off of cable version was not going to do it anymore. Citizen Kane is just one of those great classic films. It's fantastic storytelling, amazing acting, and I love the fact that it still has a central mystery that you don't necessarily pick up on the first time you see the film. After all, who heard him say Rosebud? Number 1. Captain Blood, 1935. That's right, my favorite film of all time is Captain Blood, an Errol Flynn film. Actually, it's no secret that this is my favorite film of all time. I talk about it pretty regularly. Captain Blood was Errol Flynn's first leading role in a film, and it turned him into a star. 70-some-odd years later, it's still easy to see why. Captain Blood has daring heroics, amazing swordplay, big action sequences, strong characters, and a great romance with one of the most beautiful women to ever make movies. Flynn's handsome and graceful but masculine on-screen presence made both men and women flock to his movies for escapist fun for nearly 20 years. Captain Blood is as good an example of excellent Hollywood filmmaking as I think I can imagine. It's one of the greatest pirate films ever made and my own personal favorite movie of all time, so hey. If you don't know anything about Captain Blood, let me lay things out here for you. Flynn plays Dr. Peter Blood, who, in 1685, is arrested and sentenced to slavery for treating rebels wounded in battle against the British crown. Shipped to the town of Port Royal in Jamaica, he is bought in a fit of pique by Arabella Bishop, played by Olivia de Havilland. She's the niece of one of the island's major landowners, Colonel Bishop, played by Lionel Atwill. Unsure what to do with her impulse purchase, she drops the doctor into the regular slave population working her uncle's plantation. Using his medical skills to treat the island governor's gout, Blood gains some privileges and secretly arranges to buy a boat for an escape attempt from the island. Instead, fate intervenes when a Spanish attack on the colony enables him to steal a full-size ship and make an escape with his fellow liberated slaves as the crew. Turning to piracy, Blood spends the next few years plundering any and all vessels that come under his sword, until a partnership with flamboyant French pirate Captain Levasseur, played by Basil Rathbone, goes badly awry. Having captured the ship bringing Miss Bishop back to the Caribbean from England, Levasseur plans to ransom her, but Blood, emotionally torn about this beautiful, kind woman, tries to buy her away. When this fails, the two captains fight to the death, and Blood walks away with the lady his prisoner. At first, relishing the turn of slave to master, he ultimately cannot treat her cruelly and stubbornly sets out to return her to Port Royal, even though he'll most likely be caught there and hanged by her uncle, who has since become Jamaica's new governor. But there's a surprise or two at the island for Captain Blood and his crew that will test their loyalties and their fighting abilities. Oh, I love this film. It is so remarkable an adaptation of the Raphael Sabatini novel that when I finally read the book years after having watched the movie multiple times, I was completely shocked by its fidelity. I expected the usual monkeying typical of the movies, but clearly Warner Brothers saw a great adventure story with exactly what Hollywood needed and stuck to it. In fact, like most novels of its time, the story seems to have something for nearly everyone, and that's without any Hollywood monkeying. It's got political villainy, explosive sea battles, a noble hero, a classic sword fight, a smart romance, and plenty of pirate action. Often with adventure movies, there is little time for smaller, quieter moments, but Captain Blood has sharply drawn minor characters, and even the dialogue is clever, with dozens of smart, quotable lines that linger long after the fun is over. A movie with so many elements could have easily flown out of control, but as directed by the great Michael Curtiz, it never feels frantic, but rather moves so smoothly it seems to be a much shorter film than it really is. Indeed, what at first glance seems to be an episodic story of a man's fall from respected citizen to thief and pirate, and then his lucky return to grace, reveals itself in hindsight to be a remarkably linear tale of overcoming unjust, oppressive authority. Of course, none of that would matter if the film wasn't fun, and on that front, Captain Blood succeeds admirably. This is two of the most entertaining hours I have ever spent watching a film, and I never tire of introducing new people to this classic film. Sadly, seeing Captain Blood in its original form hasn't always been easy. When I first saw and fell in love with it on commercial television, this was when I was much younger. When I first saw and fell in love with it on commercial television and its first VHS release, the running time was 99 minutes. To accommodate the necessities of a two-hour time slot on television, a full 20 minutes of character and detail had been snipped out of the movie. And for decades, that was the only version of the movie available to see. Some have argued that these cuts didn't hurt the film, that at full length, it's overcrowded and too busy. I find this to be ridiculous. These are the types of folks that would look at a gourmet banquet and complain that their plate was too small. Luckily, in the late 1980s, Ted Turner's TBS cable station started showing a beautiful uncut print, all 119 minutes, but only colorized. Oh, man. But then, in 1993, The full, almost 2-hour-long cut was released on tape, and then later Laserdisc, with a banner on the cover that made Flynn fans' hearts flutter. It said in quotes, "In glorious black and white." And then, the release of Captain Blood on DVD several years back put one more sword thrust into the shorter edit, relegating it to a reference book footnote. No one need ever seek out that shorter cut of the film. Trust me. See the full 2-hour length cut. It's fun, it's funny, it's brilliant. There's a reason Captain Blood's my favorite film of all time. It is fantastic.
Hello, and welcome to a commercial for Hello, This is the Doom Show. I'm Richard.
I'm Brad.
And on the podcast that is known as Hello, This is the Doom Show, we talk about giallo movies, slasher movies, horror movies.
We're going to interview Cary Grant live in the studio.
We're going to interview Lucio Fulci in the studio, folks. We're going to put Cary Grant in the studio with Lucio Fulci. It's the interview you never thought would happen.
I'm going to wear my Vincent Price slacks.
I'm going to wear my Citizen Kane wristwatch and monocle. And now Brad is going to recite the Pledge of Allegiance in Portuguese. Brad, go.
I don't know Portuguese.
Go! Go!
Stop hitting me!
You're a natural actor.
Yeah.
You can listen to us at hellodoomedshow.podomatic.com, or you can find the archive at doomedmoviethon.com.
Okay, folks, that wraps up my top 10, my favorite 10 movies of all time. I think that probably sometime in the near future, I will do a second top 10. That would be 11 through 20, because any list like this has a tendency to make people think about the films that they would put in their top 10. And since it's my list, it just makes me think about what the next 10 favorite movies would be. So soon, I will probably put that out there. Right now, I want you to know that if you want to give me your opinion of my top 10, or maybe just drop your top 10 in my lap so that we can discuss it, you can write to me here at thebloodypit@gmail.com. That's right, thebloodypit@gmail.com. Once again, soon I will have many guests on future shows, and we will be discussing many, many different types of films. And in most cases, they won't be highbrow things or things that are considered regular, normal, everyday classics like Citizen Kane or even Planet of the Apes, necessarily. It'll be more toward the exploitation, science fiction, and horror realm. But thought giving you an idea of the kind of films that I hold up and think of as truly great movies would give you the basic lowdown on how I think and feel about movies. And like I say, let me have your top 10. It's always fun for discussion. Now, a few years ago, and for a couple of years, I did reviews for a podcast for a buddy over in England. The name of the podcast is Starship Sofa, and for a little while, I did movie reviews, science fiction movie reviews, for Starship Sofa. Every now and then, I'm reminded of them, and recently, something has happened that's made me think about one of the reviews that I did at the time. Back a couple of years ago, when Tron Legacy came out, the sequel to the legendary 1982 film Tron, I went to see it and was a bit shocked to actually enjoy it. I did a review of it for Starship Sofa, and what has Tron on my mind right now is the odd fact that Disney is about to release a cartoon series on their Disney XD TV station, their cable station. And I have to be honest, I've seen the preview stuff for it, and I'm a little excited about it. It looks like it might be pretty good. It's called Tron Uprising. Supposedly there's going to be 18 episodes in the first season of it. They got Bruce Boxleitner back doing the voice of Tron. There's a new character named Beck, going to be voiced by Elijah Wood. So I'm kind of intrigued. The look at some of the images that I've seen online makes me think I might have to check this out. I think I'll have to set the DVR and see what it looks like. Well, here's what I'm going to do. In anticipation of Tron Uprising and the hopes that it will be worth seeing, here's my, well, couple of years old now review of Tron Legacy, and I'll come back after this and we'll see you out. Hello, everybody. I'm going to have to admit up front that I'm probably not the right guy to be reviewing a sequel to the movie Tron. Because you see, I've tried many times over the years, but I have still never managed to sit all the way through the entire film. I think I've seen the entire film in bits and pieces spread out over the past 28 years or so, but I've always found the thing so stinking boring that I just can't manage it. It's truly dull. It was made in 1982 during that horrible period when Disney just couldn't make a good film if you begged them to. Tron is a beloved movie, though. Not just amongst computer geeks, either. I mean, it's got its cult following. And in a way, I guess it really kind of has a reason to have a cult following. I mean, there's no other movie that's ever really looked that way. It doesn't have any sense of having been done before. It looks unique. Even today, well, I say even today, even though it's almost impossible to see it right now. It's very, very difficult to find a copy to rent or buy. It certainly can't buy it. The DVD's out of print. And you'd have thought that that was something that Disney, always willing to make a buck, would have seen was available, especially at Christmas time. Can you imagine how many copies of Tron on DVD and, gasp, Blu-ray they would have sold for Christmas? Especially since we've got the long-awaited, 28 years later, sequel hitting theaters just before Christmas. Very strange. Not sure exactly why they did that. But nevertheless, here it is, and we have a Tron sequel. Now, as I've said, I'm not a big fan of the original film. I don't think it's a terrible movie, I just think it's incredibly dull. So, you can guess that I went into this film, Tron Legacy, with lowered expectations. And I'm going to tell you right up front that that's probably the best way for anybody to go see Tron Legacy. I have a few friends who are big Tron fans, and they were a bit disappointed. They felt it was a little boring, and they were a little underwhelmed. Not by the visuals. Oh no, not the visuals. But let's talk about the plot, such as it is, and then we'll talk a little bit more about the film. Tron Legacy tells the story of a young boy and his beautiful dog. Oh, wait, no. Forget that. Scratch it. That's another film entirely. No. Tron Legacy tells the story of Sam Flynn. He's the son of Kevin Flynn, who was the main character of the first Tron film. Kevin Flynn is played by Jeff Bridges. Sam Flynn is played by a newcomer named Garrett Hudlin, and he does a pretty good job in kind of looks like he could be Jeff Bridges' son in a sort of kind of way. See, Kevin Flynn was a computer visionary that disappeared 20 years earlier after telling his son that he'd witnessed a miracle that would change the world. Now, after disappearing, everybody, including his son Sam, suspect that his father simply ran away. He's pretty bitter about it, and he continues to dodge his responsibilities as the primary shareholder of his father's global corporation, and spends his time kind of rebelling against the company and what he perceives as his heritage. Kevin's old friend, and Sam's sometime kind of surrogate stepfather, Alan, who's played by Bruce Boxleitner, also from the original film, tells Sam that he received a page from Kevin's old arcade, which featured, of course, prominently in the first film. Sam doesn't really think there's anything to this, but he goes to the arcade to look around anyway, and discovers a secret room with a computer and some material that seems to actually be active. Quicker than you can say, let's get this story started, the same thing that happened to his father in the first film happens to the son, and a laser digitizes him and transports him into the computer reality. So Sam, of course, finds himself in the computerized world known as the Grid, where he's quickly captured and forced into games for the amusement of the Grid's new boss. Now, in the first film, the great David Warner played the evil boss of the grid, the Master Control Program. And yes, I actually managed to remember that without having to look it up. In this film, you don't have David Warner, but they have pulled out a pretty interesting little trick, which is the main reason I actually wanted to see this movie. Because in this film, the bad guy is played by Jeff Bridges. How is this, you say? Isn't Jeff Bridges in the film as Kevin Flynn, the father, the lost father that the son then finds? Why, yes, he is. But Bridges plays both characters. And in a very interesting turn of computer CGI event, he's made to look like his younger self to play the villainous role. This is some very good CGI and well worth seeing. But I will admit that because the character is on screen for so long a period of time, eventually it goes from being very interesting to being slightly creepy to really not looking as realistic as it probably ought to. But that being said, the creepy Jeff Bridges made younger thing isn't bad enough to really upset the viewer. There are other things, though, that I think that might upset viewers. There's very little light humor in this film. It's pretty dark, actually. As a matter of fact, it has the kind of dark feel of a film that you would kind of expect made in this day and age. It's not as dark as, say, something like Blade Runner or Alien or something of that nature, but it is a dark film in tone and in the way it carries the action forward from set piece to set piece. And that is a big break from the original film, which had a good deal of light joking and some general good-natured humor. This film doesn't have that.
The tone of this film is a little bit darker, but it's not overly dark. I mean, the film is rated PG, for goodness sake. But that is something you should be aware of. It does look spectacular. That Blade Runner idea that I tossed out a second ago is about right. That really is the idea for how this film looks. Nice, dark, interestingly detailed. But let's be blunt. The reason somebody's going to go see this film, at least people who aren't already Tron enthusiasts, and I can't believe I just used that phrase, are people who are looking for an action film, because that's how the trailer sells this movie. Plenty of action. And once Sam is inside the grid, he is, of course, immediately placed within the games, which are a big part of the whole reason for Tron. I mean, it is a video game to a large degree, right? And that's some very exciting stuff. The light cycles, the throwing of the discs thing, the whole shattering of people that I'm sure you've seen in the trailers by now. All very interesting, all very exciting. And also just as empty as you would expect. Just as empty as they were in the first film. I don't know that that's necessarily a critique of the film. I mean, that's what it's supposed to be to a degree, but I will say that although I did enjoy the action scenes for the most part, there were more than a few points where I couldn't quite work out where, say, a light cycle was or what level it was on or how these two things might eventually connect or get in the way of each other. And later on in the film, when you're flying around in all these flying machines, I had a similar problem, not being quite sure exactly where things were at times. It's not hyperactive editing, it's more along the lines of everything in the background looking extremely dark and pretty much the same, so there's really very little chance to have some grasp of exactly where things are. But still an exciting film, still a section of the film that I enjoyed, and I think most people would enjoy to a certain degree. I think that for most people, especially science fiction fans, you've already made your decision on whether or not you're going to see Tron Legacy. You either really, really love the old film or you're just curious enough to go see this one because, hey, there's nothing else science fiction out there right now. But I'm here to tell you, it's not as bad as some people are saying. It's also not anywhere near the classic that for some reason some people were hoping it was going to be. But it's a passable enough time waster. That's, I guess, damning it with faint praise, huh? Well, I would like to single these things out. Jeff Bridges is really good in both of his roles, of course, even though his lips do look weird the longer they're on when he's in that young guy phase. Bruce Boxleitner is very, very good, known primarily, of course, as Tron, from the first film, but as a TV actor who really came into his own doing 5 years of Babylon 5 on television, he turns in a fantastic performance and does a really good job. And I'd like to point out a very odd bit of casting as well, something that I haven't heard anybody else drawing a lot of attention to, and that is a small role played by Cillian Murphy. Excellent actor. He played Scarecrow in Batman Begins and The Dark Knight. He was in Danny Boyle's Sunshine and numerous other films. Very good actor. But I can't for the life of me figure out why they cast such a well-known and good actor in such a tiny, tiny role. I kept thinking that surely Murphy was going to show up on the grid playing some bad guy character, right? But he never did, which makes me think that they might just be trying to set up, tenuously anyway, a third Tron film. And I'm guessing that I'm probably right. And I'm also guessing that it won't take 28 years before it comes out, if this one does well enough. Interesting. Strange. It's hard to miss him. He has a good bit of dialogue in the one sequence near the beginning of the film that he's in. Strange. Strange. So, I kind of give a half-hearted thumbs up to Tron Legacy. It's worth seeing if you're curious. If you're not curious, don't bother. But it's an okay time at the movies. Stay well and stay warm, hopefully inside a cinema watching a good film. Wow, that was a bit more of a blast from the past than I remembered it being. Okay, well then, folks, if you are fans of Tron, or Tron Legacy, or Tron Uprising, send me an email, thebloodypit@gmail.com. Tell me why I should watch the 1982 film. Tell me why I should have enjoyed Tron Legacy a bit more. Don't ever watch anything in 3D, folks. 3D is the work of the devil, and all it does is take your money away from you for nothing. Nothing, I tell you. Okay, I'm not going to rant about 3D. That's a subject for a whole other podcast. Right now, I'm going to thank you for tuning in. Try to convince you to send me your list of top 10 favorite films of all time. And I guess we'll just see you next time, folks. Be good, and we will talk to you again soon.